1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 6 says that love does not rejoice in unrighteousness. It's one of the things it does not do. But it rejoices in or with the truth. Love rejoices in truth. Do you rejoice in the truth? How do we get the truth? How do we understand the truth? You know, Jesus said in John chapter 14, verse 6, he said, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Then it says in verse 25, this is Romans 1 and verse 25. When Paul was talking about the Gentile philosophers and everything, and this is what he said, for they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. They exchanged it. Here, take the truth of God, give me a lie back. And they worshiped and served the Creator more than the creature, rather than the creator who is blessed forever. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie. The truth is not easy. First of all, it's not easy to come to. Second of all, it's not easy to always to accept. In the book of Jeremiah was describing the people of his time, but I think he made a general statement, and I think if we take a look at some of these, we'll give you some principles. I think this characterizes all of our minds in some ways. Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 9, in the New American Standard Version, reads, the heart is more deceitful than all else. Now, that's not your ticker, you know, not the physical heart. He's not talking about your personal heart. He's talking about a metaphor, the heart of man, which is the heart, the very being of your mind. Everything about you that's in your mind is more deceitful. Who has deceived me more than anybody but myself? I've deceived myself more than almost anybody, because it's easy to deceive yourself. It's easy to kid yourself. It's easy to see and want the wrong things or do the wrong thing or accept the wrong ideas. The heart is more deceitful than all else and is desperately sick, says the New American Standard Version. Who can understand it? King James says wicked. But it has to do with something not right. Listen to how the New English translators translate that. New English translation goes like this. The human mind, that's what he's talking about when he talks the heart, is more deceitful than anything else. It is incurably bad. Who can understand it? The human mind. Your mind, my mind, are the human minds. So let me give you some general principles of all of us, of our minds, okay? What happens to our minds? How do we tend to do things? And some of the philosophers understand this. Some of them, you know, they talk about it. People in general, meaning you and me and all kinds of people, people in general tend to believe what they want to believe. You believe what you really want to believe. You want to believe about something, right? You hold beliefs. People hold beliefs. You see, they hold beliefs even in the face of contradictory evidence to the contrary. They'll hold belief. People tend to project their own biases and their experiences upon situations. You see a situation, you project your bias or your experience. I had an experience like that, I understand it, and you project that onto the situation. Once you do that, we call it in psychology, we call it seeing through filters. People don't often see what is there. We see through a set of mind filters. Everything has to go through these filters. So when you see something, whether it's a human situation, whether it's a factual situation, whether it's a situation of nature, you tend to see it through your filters. And what are the filters of your mind? They're your own experiences. They're what you've been taught when you grew up. They're, you know, most of us didn't choose where we were born or where we grew up or what our parents, what religion our parents were. We just accepted it because we thought that was right. You know, we were taught it was right. And so you just kind of grow up accepting what is. And we see through a set of filters. We project our biases. Those biases and those experiences become filters, filtering the information, the knowledge that keeps coming to you. People tend to generalize from a specific event to everything. You generalize from a specific event. You get burned once. Now, I'll give you an example. When we were first married, we went to a little fair. You know, it was a county fair. We went there, and this guy suckered me into tossing these rings. They were only like, you know, you toss them, and if you toss them, you win so many points. He said, "Here, I'll give you three free. If you get so many points, you can win this." And I hear I'm got my new bride with me, and I wanted to win her something, and I threw a ring. And he said, "Oh, you got 45 points already. Toward 100, you get 100 points. Wow." Threw another ring. "Hey, there's 30 points. You only need 25 more points." Wow. I threw the last ring. I'm bound to get 100, and I'm just so proud of myself, you know. And he said, "Oh, they only got 5 points on this. So you got 80 of the 100 points." Now, he said, "Now, if you pay me $1 or $2, then you can throw more, three more." He said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll let you have half of these points, and you can, you know, already." "Okay, three more." And I threw one, and he said, "Okay, well, that's a minus 20 points. And then I throw another one, and that's, you know, and it keeps going. I don't know what happened. I don't know where my mind went. All I do know is where my dollars went. And when we left there, I'd had no money. And soon as we were done, my wife said, "Hey, well, what?" And he closed down the thing. Well, you know, he shut it down and took off. In those days, it was about $40. But $40, when you only made $80 a week, was half your salary. So I'm like, oh. And you know that from that specific event, I never went to another county fair for like 30 years. Now, do you think county fairs would really hurt me? I generalize from that event to all events. You see how my mind worked? People generalize from a specific event to all the events. That's not a correct way of reasoning. People tend to get personally involved in the analysis of an issue, and they tend to let their feelings overcome a sense of objectivity, how they feel. They get personally, feelingly involved in an issue. And their feelings override their objectivity. People in general are not good listeners. They're not good listeners. They tend to hear selectively. They tend to listen for what they want to hear. Okay? They hear what they want to hear. They listen to a speech. And will he say anything about taxes? And if he says, "Well, you know, I'm going to try to hold down taxes. Ha, 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 I like that. He's going to hold down taxes. I know they just listen for what they selected. Even though he said, you know, we might have to raise taxes. They don't. And the other people, they're listening for what he must raise taxes. And they hear that. So everybody listens selectively. You do too. I do. It's our natural way of dealing with things. People are eager to rationalize, to justify what they do, what they believe, how they feel. They rationalize it. People are often unable to distinguish what is relevant from what is irrelevant. We're talking about an issue. I'll try to give you some examples of these. they don't distinguish what is relevant to the issue versus what is irrelevant to the issue. Okay, there's some things that are irrelevant, and they can't distinguish them. People are easily diverted from the specific issue at hand. There's an issue at hand, and it's easy to divert people, to divert the mind from that issue. You'll see it happen all the time in meetings. They're supposed to be talking about this, and then somebody bring this up, and then the meeting drifts, and you know, what we were talking about over here is left, and we go over to here to that, and first thing you know, we're drifting, and we're diverted. We're talking about something else, has nothing to do with what we really wanted to deal with, and the whole meeting just kind of just drifts away because people are diverting it. People are usually unwilling to explore thoroughly the ramifications of a topic. They tend to oversimplify most issues. People often judge from appearances. They observe something, they misinterpret what they observe, and they make terrible errors in judgment. They judge from appearance. What it appears to be must be what it is. And they don't often investigate further. They just take the top of the thing and they make decisions. People simply don't know often what they're talking about, especially in matters of discussion. They rarely think carefully before they speak. They allow their feelings, prejudices, bias, likes, dislikes, hopes, frustrations to supersede careful thinking. Now you might think that sounds like a harsh condemnation of people. It's not a harsh condemnation. It's just the way we as people tend to be. People rarely act according to a set of consistent standards. Rarely do they examine the evidence and then form a conclusion. Rather, they tend to do whatever they want to do, believe whatever they want to believe, find whatever the evidence they to support their actions or their beliefs. They often think selectively in evaluating a situation. They are eager to find reasons to support what they want to do and to support what they are just as eager to ignore. And they disregard what doesn't support what they want to do. People often don't say what they mean and often don't mean what they say. Now again, these statements are not meant for put downs or criticisms or judgments. We are all, include me, in that category. Because the path to truth is rarely followed because the path of least resistance is rarely the path to truth, isn't it? It's easier to do those things than it is to think critically, to be careful with what you say and do, and to watch, you know, the words that you choose. Very hard. And let me give you some examples of things that are often said. For instance, emotional language is used, and it's used in propaganda. It's used in, you know, we just had some campaigns, and we have election campaigns, political campaigns. And here's some kinds of language that people use to persuade others. Are you persuaded by this? Here's what is called the bandwagon approach. Everyone's doing it. You know, everyone is getting one of these. So what does that mean? What does that mean to you when you hear somebody say, everyone is doing it? Well, right away you think, well, if everyone's doing it, guess what? I must do it too. But is that really a biblical statement? Is that the way Jesus would have said it? What did Jesus say? Broad is the way, wide is the gate, and many go in there. And narrow is the passage, you know, narrow is the gate, and small, and strict, straight, and difficult is the way that leads to life. Just the fact that most people do it doesn't mean anything. You shouldn't be persuaded at all by what most people do. One of the other techniques of propaganda persuasion is repetition. If we just say the same thing over and over and over, After a while, the idea is if you say it often enough, people will believe it. That was one of Hitler's greatest propagandists. He just said, we just keep saying it. We just keep saying it that Jesus was not a Jew. He was an Aryan. And if we just keep saying it, people will finally believe it and accept it. Because he hated the Jews. You remember, Jesus couldn't have been one because he hated the Jews. So yeah, if this is the case. The other thing is when people speak confidently, you have a strong, confident look, and people talk like they know what they're saying, okay? That is often, you speak like you know it, and people will think you know, even though you don't know. The other persuasion is sincerity. Well, he seems so sincere. She seems so sincere. And maybe 100% is sincere. You know, that person was so sincere. Well, let me ask you a question. Is sincerity by itself a truth? No, it just means the person truly believes what they're saying. But, you know, you can be sincere and sincerely wrong. The fact that someone is sincere has absolutely nothing to do with truth. Correct? Am I right? Otherwise, you wouldn't have the word deceive. The Bible says that the whole world, that Satan has deceived the whole world, that most people are deceived. Well, if that's the case, they had to be sincere. They may be sincerely, they sincerely believe what they believe. There are many people who sincerely believe it, even though it is wrong. Oversimplification. We oversimplify the issue by doing certain things like all or nothing. Here's oversimplification. You're either part of the problem or part of the solution. Wait a second. If you're not a part of the solution, you're part of the problem. Why am I part of the problem if I'm not a part of the solution? But we oversimplify. It becomes an all or nothing choice. Here's an oversimplification. It was used during the O.J. Simpson trial. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. One piece of evidence, the glove didn't seem to fit. Now you have to ignore all other pieces of evidence. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. That's just oversimplification, just not correct. But people are often persuaded by these little techniques. Name calling is a major way of dealing with things. People use the word radical, racist, anarchist, extremist, you know, communist, socialist, I mean, any of the right winger and all that. You ever notice how people tend to, there's emotional language involved, you see, emotional language. Let's take a look at an emotional language. If I am against abortion, and I want to talk, I call myself pro-life, and I call the other side pro-abortion. They want abortion. I want life. So notice how I frame it. The other side frames it like this. We're pro-choice. They want to take a woman's right of choice away. They want to force things on people and don't want to give women a choice in their of their bodies. So again, here's how the thing is framed. Each person framing it the way they want. Here's another technique called plain folks. You'll see that this was done in the last lecture. I'm just like you. I'm just like one of you. Remember that? That's a technique. In other words, you'll be persuaded to vote for me if I'm just like one of you and not anything special. On the other hand, then when you sell things, there's a snob appeal. Some products will use a snob appeal. This product is not for everyone, you know. It's quality for the quality person, you know. You have to be at a certain level, you know. It's a snob appeal. Not everybody appreciates the quality, the finery. This is for the person of discriminating tastes. You see, the snob appeal. Okay, I want to be up there. And people are often persuaded with that. Often people use statistics. Now, if you're persuaded by when somebody says 80% of the people agree with me, 80% of the people want or say they're going to vote for me. How do we get 80% of the people? Do you know that I could get 80% of the people to agree with any statement I make? Practically any statement, I can get 80%. I can come back with a statistic saying I have 80%. I go out and I find five people that agree pretty much that I think are on my side, okay? If four of them say, yeah, you know, I agree with that, I come back and say 80% of the people. Now, you know that when you say 80% of people, you cannot possibly survey all the people. You know that, right? Well, how do they get then when they say 80% of Americans, 80% of the voters, 80%? Well, how do they get that? They take a sample of people. You take a sample and then you say 80% or so many doctors use our, recommend our thing. Well, yeah, well, you sell it, send it to them free or recommend that they do it. And 80% of the doctors will recommend your particular medication. What's that mean? Nothing. If I find four out of five who agree with me, I say then I try to make that be, you know, how many people did you survey, first of all, for 80%? Where did you survey them? Were they randomly chosen? You'll see on broadcasts every now and then they'll say, you know, call in and give us your opinion. And if they're real truthful, they'll put a little statement at the bottom of the screen. This is not a scientific survey. To be a scientific survey, it has to be random. We also have emotional language. People hear things on two levels. Everything is said on two levels. We have a statement, the statement which is the context of the statement, and then there's the subcontext, the other side, the emotional side, what you hear beneath it. Okay, let me give you some examples. So communication operates on two levels, the statement and the statement behind the statement. Listen to this statement. And based on the accent that I put on it, it has different meanings. I never tried to cheat on my income tax. You hear that phrase? I never tried to cheat on my income tax. If I just write that out, you don't know what word I'm emphasizing, but sometimes you can do it by capitalization and underline and italics and all that. But listen to what it means when I say, I never try to cheat on my income tax. That means what? I never do it, but other people do. Probably you do it, and you know she does it. I never try to cheat. Now, if I say, I never try to cheat on my income tax, what would that mean? Well, I probably do, but I never really tried to do it. Okay, I never try to cheat on my income tax. Means I never tried to cheat, but, you know, I might do other sleight of hand. I do everything I can, but not illegally. I never try to cheat on my income tax. Well, that means I may be an accountant. I cheat for other people, but I never do it on my income tax. I never try to cheat on my income tax. If I emphasize income, I change the meaning of that whole sentence. I might cheat on my other taxes, but not on my income tax. You see how the thing can change by emphasizing different words? You're not always aware of the emphasis of these words. You hear them, and they just go right by you. Here's a way that people divert. It's an irrelevance. Okay, this is irrelevant. Mother asks her daughter, how are you doing in English this year, this term? And her daughter says, oh, I just got a 95 on a quiz. Did that tell how she was doing in English this term? But it's enough to divert. Most people are going to be totally diverted. Oh, I just got a 95 on a quiz. That didn't tell us what her grade was for the semester. That doesn't tell us whether she turned in her papers on time. That doesn't tell us what she got on her annual theme or her particular paper. She doesn't tell us anything. It just says, I got a 95 on a quiz, and that diverts Mama. Okay, oh, good, you got a 95 on a quiz, you know. Well, a quiz may have been four questions or six questions that he had just popped up, and you got a 95 on, or whatever it was. And it may not, how much was that quiz to your whole semester grade? Nobody asks. It's very oversimplified. See, people will accept that. Listen to the tone of voice and how that changes things, and the choice of words. Okay, suppose we're in a school. The school has a rule that children are allowed to smoke. We're not allowed to smoke. And we want teachers to tell us when somebody is smoking. Okay? Now, I'm a teacher, and I have Bobby Jones in my class. I like Bobby. He's been okay. You know, he's improving. But I found him smoking. Okay? Now I got to report this to the principal. Now, how I say this means all the difference in the world. Now, listen how I might say it. I come into the principal's office, I tone a voice, and I say, you know, I just came across Bobby Jones smoking, and he's been doing so well lately. How do you think the principal is going to react to my presentation? Now, suppose I didn't like Bobby Jones. I didn't like this kid. I wish he would just be suspended. I wish somebody would crack his knuckles or something. And I come in and I say like this. I caught Jones smoking in the bathroom. Different language. How about this? Betty is late. As opposed to, Betty has not arrived yet. You see, how I put that word. I mean, it's the same thing, right? She's not here. One is, Betty is late, which is a censor, condemnation. Betty has not arrived yet. Yes, oh, well, she's trying to get here. But late implies she doesn't care. Late implies she is all these other, it's a judgment. Late is a judgment. Betty is not arrived yet implies she's trying to get here. She's really striving. She's home, you know, but she just can't make it. We have loaded language all the time. Loaded language can be, you know, this place is a dump. As soon as you hear that the place is a dump, he's a jerk. You know, how someone, oh yeah, I know him, he's a jerk. As soon as you say the word jerk, you know, what's the person, well, now what are you supposed to plead? Or he was green with envy. Well, that means he's really a nasty person. Well, how about this one? Carolyn slinked up next to Bob to sit next to Bob. Notice the word slinked up. What does that imply about Carolyn? She slinked up next to Bob. What kind of impression are you getting about Carolyn? You know, she's really seductive, you know, all that. So our word choices are loaded. Let me read you an article that appeared in a magazine about 1960 when the Laetrile controversy was going on. You know what Laetrile is? Some of you don't know. You never heard of Laetrile. It's been off the market. The FDA banned it. You're not allowed to have it. And for a while, it was almost like you couldn't buy the apricot kernels that it was made from. It was made from apricot, the kernels inside the seed of an apricot. And they were considered to be, and somebody tried them, and they were anti-tumorous in rats. And they became a major production to say that this might be helpful to cancer, and people started buying it, and the Food and Drug Administration shut it down. Shut down the program, and it was forbidden. Okay. This is an article that was written in a major magazine about Laetrile and the people that found it. Here it is. Listen to the loaded language. Just want you to see if you can hear it. Now that I've given you some ideas, I want you to hear it. Laetrile origins go back to the 1920s when Dr. Ernst Krebs, a San Francisco physician, was looking for a substance to improve the flavor of bootleg whiskey. On a hunch, he turned his attention to finding a substance that would cure cancer. and eventually discovered a crude apricot extract that seemed to have an anti-tumor effect in rats. However, it quickly proved of doubtful value for use in humans. Then in 1949, Ernst Krebs Jr., a biochemist and medical school dropout, purified his father's extract and isolated the active ingredient. Next to Krebs, the major figure in the Laetrile movement is the 60-year-old Andrew McNaughton, a picaresque entrepreneur who acted as a double agent in the Castro-Cuban revolt and once sold arms to a foreign country. He started a foundation for the exploration of offbeat scientific theories. After a 1956 meeting with Krebs in a Miami drugstore, McNaughton made Laetrile the number one item on the foundation's agenda. End quote. You notice how the language is loaded to convey, you know, these are just fly-by-nighters. It never dealt with whether or not this apricot kernel extract factually, nobody ever tested it scientifically to see whether, in fact, now a lot of people swore by it. And I told my parents about it many years ago, and my dad, every time he went out and bought a bushel of apricots, and they ate the apricots, he would always save them, and he went down and he cracked them down with his little vise, and you know, and then he just cracked those the seeds and ate that kernel. I just said, you know, just eat one or two a day, Dad, and that's all you need. And he and Mom did. You know, my folks both lived to be 97, and my mother lived to be 96. Neither one had any cancer that we know of. They didn't die from cancer. They were cancer-free. And there's a lot of information saying that if you eat seeds of all kinds, seeds, apricot kernel, you can buy them in the health food store now. There for a while, it was like, if you buy that, you know, might be careful. But the health food store owner will never say they're good for anything. Because if you say that, then you could be shut down and stopped to say that, and you'll be put out of business. So that's one of the ways. All right. Now, I got a call the other day. I'm not a call. I got an email from a very sincere man, very sincere, who wanted to tell me that, you know, he'd read some of the things I'd written. He'd heard some of the things I'd spoken. And he could not understand. He didn't think that I really was careful or that I didn't really look at this controversy that Jesus pre-existed before his human birth. How could I believe that Jesus pre-existed before his birth? He says the very idea that someone pre-existed is contradictory. You know, I mean, I'm saying that he existed before he became a human. That's what I'm saying. He's saying you can't say that, and that's not correct. Jesus did not do that. There's only one God. Now, again, if you take this one God controversy based on the things we're saying, and you define, if you define that there's only one God, one person being God, then, of course, you have won the battle, right? If you make the definition that only one person, God is one person, if you make that statement, then, of course, you win. You win the argument, because if God is only one person, if God meaning one person. So when I gave my talk, I tried to give a fairly scientific approach and careful about my statements. And I said that my talk about Jesus, you know, being deity, being divine, was based on the inspired word of God, and that I believed my premises were that the New Testament was as much the word of God as the Old Testament. I had another premise, that the text of the New Testament is more reliable in its readings than the text of the Old Testament. The Greek is more specific. The Hebrew words are often, because they have no vowels, can often be, you know, how many things can you say it has no vowels? It can mean this, it can mean that, right? That the New Testament is essential revelation of things not known without it. Otherwise, God wouldn't have given us the New Testament if you could know those things without having it. That the New Testament scriptures were inspired in the Greek language. I believe that. Now, these are the principles and the premises under which I spoke. And that there is a principle of progressive revelation. For instance, that at one time circumcision was, commanded, but in the New Testament, Paul says circumcision is nothing in regard to salvation, being a Christian or accepting Christ or having salvation. And that my other premise was that Jesus was literally born of a virgin, and that he was literally the Son of God with the Father's, God the Father's seed in him. The other premise was that the weight of Old Testament passages, in other words, you could take many Old Testament passages and weigh them against fewer New Testament passages, and that weight against them was not a factor in determining truth, right? I could, for instance, there's probably a larger portion of Old Testament passages on circumcision and the fact that circumcision must be observed, whereas in the New Testament, there are only a couple of statements about circumcision and the fact that it does not need to be forced on people to be converted. And same way goes with all the sacrificial laws. I mean, you got lots of sacrificial laws and lots of chapters in the Old Testament about sacrificial laws, but very small amount in the New Testament. But do we do sacrificial laws today? No. All right, so we have a number of these things. So, we don't sew ribbons on the borders of our garments today, even though that's a law, and there's a lot of special time used on it. I wanted to deal with the idea of one God. Now, if you turn to Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 4, here's what is called the Shema, the Shema, meaning hear. It's in the Hebrew, it means hear. Okay, listen up. So in verse 4, hear, O Israel, the Eternal, our God, the Eternal is one. See that? In verse 4. The Eternal is one. Now, again, how do you interpret one? Now, the word one in the Hebrew is a particular word. It's used in a lot of places. It is used in Genesis chapter 11, verse 6, where it says, "And the Eternal said, Behold, the people is one." It's the same Hebrew word. That particular word is called echad, and it's spelled, transliterated into English, E-C-H-A-D, echad. That word can mean one, or it can mean first. For instance, in the book of Genesis chapter 1 and verse 5, it says, "And the evening and the morning were one day." And it's translated like this. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening and there was morning, one day. Many places call it the first day, and the evening and morning was the first day. And then you come down to the day two. You notice there were other days. It was the first day, then the second day, and the third day. You remember that? And so you go, it's an ordinate, and it is perfectly legitimate to translate echad as first, not just one. So hear, O Israel, the Lord is one. And yet the word is used, Listen to this one, Genesis chapter 2. How is it used? You see how you oversimplify. You just read this one verse. The Lord our God, the Lord is one. There it is. That's it. God is one person. There it is. And you can't go against it. Genesis chapter 2, same word, echad, same use. Therefore, Genesis 2, verse 24. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall be joined to his wife. And they shall be one echad flesh. Two of them become one, do they not? That's what it says. And in Genesis 11, the people is one, and they have one language. And in Genesis chapter 32, verse 8, it says, if Esau come to the one company. So you can have one applying to a thing that has many things in it. It doesn't have to be one single. By the way, I pointed this out to people, and they don't like to hear this, that in the Hebrew, there's another Hebrew word that is not used here. And the word is yachid. That is Y-A-C-H-I-D, yachid. It is perfectly a good Hebrew word, and it means only or alone, solitary. It doesn't say the eternal Yahweh is alone, solitary. He could have used that word, and then you would have had no doubt what that meant. None. Because it would have said he was alone and solitary, the only, absolutely. But that didn't say only. Does it say only? It says one. The Lord is one. But I want to read you, just to take a few minutes here, I want to read you the context in which this is said. Look at verse 4. All right, we'll start. Deuteronomy 6, verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the eternal our God, the eternal is one. I maintain that could be first. He's first. You shall love the eternal your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. These words written, which I am commanding you today, shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign in your hand that they shall be a frontlets in your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Then it shall come about that when the Eternal brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you great and splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of good things which you did not fill, and hewn cisterns which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, and you eat and are satisfied. Then watch yourself that you do not forget the Eternal who brought you from the land of Egypt and out of the house of slavery. You shall fear only the Eternal your God, and you shall worship him and swear by his name. You shall not follow other gods, any of the gods of the peoples around you, who surround you. For the Eternal your God is in the midst of you, a jealous God. Otherwise, his anger of the Eternal your God will be kindled against you, and he will wipe you off the face of the earth. You shall not put the Eternal your God to the test as you've tested him at Manasseh, and so on. You shall diligently keep his commandments. What do you think God is really saying in the Shema? Hear, O Israel, is he really saying, put this post on your side. Now, when you go into all these houses and you get all this prosperity, keep looking at that so that you know that God is only one person. Keep looking at it. That God is only one person. God is only one person. Is that what the context of this passage is? Or is he really saying God has to be first in your life? You shall love the Eternal God with all your heart, with all your mind. Nothing else is as important as the Eternal your God. And you can't go following other gods. Nothing is more important than God himself. Yahweh is the most important. He's not saying, you know, go on your throne. God is only one person. Now I got to keep remembering. God, hear, O Israel, God is only one person. Hear, O Israel, God is only one person. I mean, how many people, how many Jews thought God was more than one person? They didn't even think it till Jesus came. Although even Elohim is a plural word. Elohim is a plural word. It is not uniplural. It is plain plural. But it is often used with a singular verb. Not always used with a singular verb. And this is where people get, you know, oh, well, you see, it's a plural verb, a plural word used with a singular verb. Therefore, God is he. It's only he, you know, he did it, not they did it. But there are places where the Bible says, Elohim, they went and did it. I won't have to go into all that right now. You see, people are easily deceived. People are easily deceived. I wonder how easily deceived you could be. People are easily sleight of hand, change of the words. They don't investigate further. They look at it. They oversimplify. Well, that's good enough for me. I see it there. God's one. That means one person, doesn't it? And they just go with it. The next time I want to deal with many of Jesus' statements. Was Jesus just, did he not pre-exist? This particular teaching, and is starting to rear itself again. I think we have to make sure that you and I understand what is called the truth.